extra time is exactly how I find out what's going on in the MLS.
Get lost. Get lost.
Maybe this podcast has influenced me a little bit as well.
Everybody up here, every single day, goes into the office, into the laboratory, to try to cook up some great stuff for you guys.
That's why he's here.
Oh, from New York, New York, you are listening to Extra Time, driven by Continental Tire from the AT&T 5G Virtual Studios. I am Andrew Wiebe with my partner in soccer, David Goss. That's because Charlie Davies is the victim of a flight cancellation, Dave. Huge bummer here.
Are you talking to me?
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm locked in because it's the first day of Olympic men's soccer, which is the most important international competition.
It's truly the pinnacle.
The pinnacle. So I'm sorry.
If you didn't think that right here, I was like quad boxing this.
Yeah. No, enthralled. Yeah.
The Euros, Copa America, Gold Cup, MLS.
Nothing compared to a Saudi Arabian U23 national team.
Secondary to all of this.
Yeah.
I'm still heartbroken. If the U.S. would have been there, we wouldn't even have this show.
You wake up for the women's game on Wednesday?
I didn't.
4:30 a.m.?
That was a little too early.
But you probably would have woken up for a men's U23 game.
Oh, for sure. Wouldn't have done that either. It's a little too early on this front. Hey, parent rules, man. That's what's up. Coming up on today's show, Felipe Cardenas talking Atlanta United. Why are we talking Atlanta? You know why we're talking Atlanta. He's going to help shed some light on that Gabriel Heinze situation. And maybe more importantly, certainly more importantly for Five Stripes fans, the future. What's going to happen now? How is this hiring process going to be different? What exactly did happen behind the scenes between Heinze, Joseph Martinez, this front office that led to a firing after 13 games, after we and everybody else were saying he was the crown jewel of coaching hires for this club? So Felipe, you know, from his coverage of The Athletic, has sources on all this stuff. We'll dig into that with him. Tom Boger going to be here as well. Bunch of news on the transfer front. Chris Mueller's off to Scotland. Let's see what else. We've got offers across the board for a bunch of players. Seems like LAFC are going to get a new striker from Colombia.
You have been asking for that for a while. You have to be happy. Doyle's not here. Doyle has to be ecstatic because I feel like we have spent five shows talking about LAFC signing a center forward in the last 2 months.
Well, if you like repetition here, we're also going to talk Gianluca Busio. But yes, I am very happy just to see where LAFC can go. I have my narrative, which is that they were going to be the best team in the league this year.
Everyone picked them to win the league.
Yeah, I still need them to like hold up their end of that bargain. So we'll see if a signing can help do it. Of course, we're going to talk midweek MLS, Inter Miami, dig into the U.S. national team, Canadian national team, Gold Cup quarterfinals start on Saturday. U.S. and Canada are on Sunday. But let's just start with it, man. Let's start midweek. So, I loved your tweet because sometimes midweek falls flat, but usually midweek just sort of like you're in awe at the end of it.
So I think a few things are happening. One is the standings are so condensed that there is no, we could take this one off. Whatever, we're not gonna risk these players or this moment because we'll get 3 points on the weekend. I think everything matters. And I think the other is the rosters are deeper than we've ever seen. Even with internationals going on and injuries and the condensed games, you are still seeing, I think, more consistent depth and so more quality out on the field. Every game yesterday, except for maybe two, ended just off the rails. Chances flying forward, announcers screaming, VARs overturning penalties, and then goals anyway. Unbelievable chances, unbelievable misses. So it was just every single game had this level of energy that you don't always see. And I was here for it. I'm trying to get 18 screens going at the same time as the game starts over.
I got to ask you, I've been struggling with this in my new setup down here. Like, what is your method to the madness to actually absorb a significant amount of what's going on? Because I had four screens going basically at all times last night. And I'm just like, I have one with the sound on, the others with it off. I'm glancing back and forth. I'm looking for sort of those telltale signs. Like, are players gathering? Is there an attack coming? is the referee gesturing? Are the announcers screaming on the one that I have the sound on? Like, what is your method?
It's not perfect. I've got my TV with the volume on. Then I've got the laptop, which sits right in front of me with volume on as well. So I get both of those. And then I've got my screens over in the corner that have games on as well. The way I try and do it is I try and pick a bunch of games that I'm going to like see. And then I pick a game that I'm not even going to touch. And I'm going to watch it later, like 100%.
Gotcha.
And so I'll rotate through the 7:30 Red Bull game starts. And then as that hits halftime, then I jump to an 8 o'clock game. Watch that. Then I'm back to the first game. And I try and do that with like three or four of the games. Yesterday was tough. Yesterday was tougher than a weekend because a weekend normally is spaced a little more because you have some sort of like at least a 5 p.m. kick Eastern time, if not earlier. Yesterday was tough. You guys were texting me about stuff that I was watching and I was like, I didn't even see that.
Meanwhile, Inter Miami fans are like, we didn't want to watch that. I didn't want to see that one.
At 2-0, I was like, this, I know.
Checking out. Well, I mean, to be honest, at 2-0, so did Inter Miami. They checked out as well. It was 5-0. That's where we're going to start this show, because as much as Atlanta United has captured the headlines for all the chaos going on there, Inter Miami is in the middle of an epic downward spiral. 6 straight losses for Phil Neville and the boys. 13 goals allowed in that time. Just 1 scored. I'm going to read through some quotes that Phil dropped after this one. And it is not pretty. We lost all concentration, togetherness, spirit in our heads, really. These results aren't good enough. I know the consequences. Ultimately, it is my job to make this team better. At this moment in time, they are not better, is what he's referring to. And then he said they were not a team. New England's a team. We're not a team. We don't represent the badge. We don't fight for each other, really. I mean, he's saying that's all I'm asking for. A team does this. He's implying his team does not, and I don't think that they did in this game. They basically laid down and took it from the Revs, who are a great team, an explosive team at times, but 5-0 at home after Neville said before that game on 5 straight losses that basically it's now or never. That there's no margin for error and there are no excuses. So never then, Dave? Like, is that where we're at with this project? Like, it just it doesn't really have a future. I compared it to sort of like a building that's in the middle of falling down. Like, this thing feels condemned. It feels like a matter of time before they slap the piece of paper on the front door and they just say, we've got to move on from this. Because it is not working. There's no cohesion in the roster build. It looks like Pizarro's gone. Gonzalo Higuain increasingly looks like a bust. I'm just going to say it. That's where it's at right now. Blaise Matuidi lost the ball in the second goal, put his head up to watch the whole thing happen as the entire team basically lets the Revs waltz in. Like, there's no spirit. There's no tactical identity. There's no path forward, it feels. What happens now?
I don't know, because the last piece of it is this is probably the best team they've put out since the first few weeks of the season.
Their first choice team.
Right. That was one of the things that you sort of could fall back on the last few weeks was Pizarro wasn't available. Higuain wasn't available. They didn't have the back line set up. They finally get the goalkeeper that they said they wanted because they felt they needed a goalkeeper who could play with their feet. Didn't think John McCarthy was that player. So now you get Marsman in, who gives up 5 goals in his first ever game. Not really on him, maybe one of them. So I don't know that there's anything you can fall back on at this point. And to way Phil Neville said it, he said, on paper, we're better than the Revs, which I don't think is true, but sort of also goes to the way that this whole thing's thought of, right? That on paper, right now, Blaise Matuidi's an elite MLS player, or that McCoon is, or that Figal is, when none of that's been proven, right? And that's where you then step in, and you're like, yeah, maybe, maybe Andrew Farrell's not as big a name player. He's a more successful MLS player now and in the past. And I think that's where you see some of that disconnect of what it takes to win in this league. Obviously, Gregory was a big loss in this one. He was the one big move we've seen Chris Henderson get to make. He has been a success. So that's your hope for the future, Inter Miami fans, is the new brain trust has hit on the few moves they've been able to make. But you are in this two-world situation of Inter Miami is a retirement team for players from Europe, and Inter Miami can be a legitimately competitive MLS team building the way others have with in-your-prime players, with players from South America who are maybe looking to break through, and with a ton of MLS experience as well. And that's what Nashville and Austin have relied on, and that's what Atlanta originally was successful with. I think you could say Atlanta's moved away from that at times, and that's one of the pitfalls that Inter Miami has fallen into. And you add on top of that everything that they've had to go through. Yeah, maybe if they had a great atmosphere, that would spur them to a couple more points. Then there's more confidence. That doesn't exist, didn't exist last year, and has been here or there over the course of this year.
And can you blame the fans for being skeptical?
Right. How do you now sell them for the first time? After everything that has happened,
you're firing general managers, you're firing sporting directors, you're firing coaches, you're replacing them. And now your results are even worse than they were before when it was unacceptable.
Yeah.
I mean, look, this was another quote from last night from Neville. I've said the word unacceptable in the past, he said. This feels worse than that. So I think about this team and I'm like, what's the path forward here? This might be the worst expansion build of all time. Like it truly might. They made the playoffs last year in an expanded field, but at least FC Cincinnati had the flexibility this year to go out and like get Lucho and get Brenner and get some pieces to try to change things. Like, what's the flexibility right now, unless they part with these huge name players that are on big contracts? Where is the flexibility for Chris Henderson?
They had to cut a DP, which we've
exactly
almost never
that's
seen
what
before.
I'm saying. Like, yeah. there's an element of mismanagement here from minute one.
Yeah,
that I don't know is paralleled, and I think it's going to be this years.
League, yeah, this league is very tough if you lock yourself into deals to get around and to start to build. As you said with Cincinnati, but they're actually the prime example, though, of you can't get out of deals. You can't get talent back in because you're looking to bring in players who are on freeze. Well, there's kind of a reason that they're available in that way. And then you sort of get stuck in this cycle where you're not really bringing in the quality of player that you want. The big one is Rodolfo Pizarro being sold for anywhere near what you bought him for. And that's probably only to Mexico. It's probably only to two or three clubs in Mexico. It doesn't seem like he makes sense. It's tough for Inter Miami that he's actually fallen further down the pecking order for El Tri. Because if he was getting the time he was getting a year ago with the national team, okay, he's an El Tri starter under Tata. You could see someone getting close to a number that makes sense for Miami. You get yourself out of that deal. Now you've got Gregory. Can you rebuild with someone who makes sense? Now you have a stable midfield. You have LGP behind them. That's your building blocks. But until you get rid of that player, I don't think they have the flexibility to make any other moves. And the little ones that they've tried to make haven't been able to affect things enough, right? The draft picks haven't changed things. Elvin Leerdam hasn't changed things. Jovan Jones hasn't. No. Like it's not enough to overcome the issues that they have straight down the spine.
Yeah, I mean, that was papering over significant wounds, essentially. And Phil Neville's in a weird position, because his boy is the owner. And I don't see this situation ending. Yeah, but I don't see this situation ending like some of the other ones we've seen around MLS here recently where a coach loses their job.
So here's the thing. Do you think another coach would be more successful with this group?
I don't think necessarily that that's true. I do think that – here's what I'll say. I don't know that that's true, but literally anything is better. Literally anything. You just lost six straight games. You have one goal scored in those games. And when it was a do-or-die match at home in front of your fans, you laid down and got beat 5-0 and didn't look like you were trying very hard for the majority of that game, that you were fighting for each other, that you had a cohesive anything about you. And that's damning on the players for sure, but Phil also said it after this one. It's damning on him as well. Like, he's there to do the job. He's going to keep trying to do that job. But I think there are so many flaws here and such a lack of culture, it feels like. I'm not sure that you could just plop somebody else in that seat and have it all change.
Yeah, so I just think one of the things, and we'll talk about it with Felipe, is making sure that the manager you believe in, if it's not Phil Neville, gets an opportunity. And I think it's really tough to put a manager that you want to be the future of your club in a tough situation to start. And so that's the part where I look at it and say, well, if it's not going to get better this year, why bring in a new coach and stick them with that? So you either stick with Phil Neville or you go out and get one of these interim guys who Stephen Glass was last year, Rob Valentino probably is this year, and Atlanta, Connor Casey was that for Colorado, where it's pretty known, but at least it shakes up the atmosphere and environment a little bit. So the players feel some level of relief and maybe it starts to get a little better going forward. But I don't think you go out and get someone who you think you can build this all around and throw them in a situation where it's going to be so dire so quickly and the environment is already poisoned that they're coming into. And saying all of that, this is an indictment on this club that we are even talking about this right now.
It's unacceptable. And
it does
worse
show
than
you that it's not that easy. I think everyone thought, how many times did we talk about James Rodriguez for 3 years and just how absolutely great Inter Miami was going to be no matter what?
I thought Gonzalo Higuain was going to be an absolute smash hit. I thought he was going to be, you know, maybe even at Robbie Keane levels, just in a different era of MLS. I truly thought he had that ability to do that. And the way that they were building the roster could put him in that position.
The guy had scored 20 goals at Juve.
Exactly.
Coming into it, it made sense. And so I just think it shows you how tough it is to win in this league and how tough it is to win for people who don't have experience with this league. But I will leave fans with, I think Chris Henderson's done a good job on the small things he's had so far. He's obviously won in this league, so that's your silver lining.
Agreed. Give him the keys. Say, look, we wrecked this thing. It's in a bad place, man. And that's probably what they said to him. Like, we need you to come in and, like, rebuild us from the chassis up. And that's what he's going to have to do. It's going to take years, I think. But there's clearly a problem, and it's only getting worse, it seems, for Inter Miami, who hosts Philly at the weekend, by the way. And it could get worse there as well. What else did you see midweek that caught your eye?
A lot of everything. It was chaos left and right. Honors wants us to talk about F1, by the way, which no. I don't think is going to happen. So let's start with just down the schedule, Columbus, Nashville. One, lower.com field is worth it. Like, you just tune in. It is bumping through the TV. It was awesome. I thought Columbus played better than we've seen them, especially in possession. But we've been waiting for them to get healthy and have those finishers. And it was on a plate for Kevin Molino to win it in stoppage time in his first game back. Like, this was all of it. And he puts it a few inches wide. And I think this team's good enough that they'll still make the postseason. But it's now we're past the point where they can contend at the top of the East as we thought they could.
No for them. Nashville, Dax McCarty, a little center back action, a three-man back line. That was interesting to see. They'll have some issues if Walker Zimmerman is out long-term. We haven't heard a timeline on that one.
But they got a shutout on the road.
Yeah, no, it's fine.
And Ake Loba.
He's in.
Made his debut. Didn't score, but came in super late. But you can see everything with him. Shifty, comfortable in possession, drew defenders in, beat them, drew defenders in, and found teammates, went down to the corner, killed a couple minutes for them as well. So super exciting. He played up top alongside Cadiz late as a sub, but that shows you at least that Gary Smith is thinking about how they can work together.
Nothing changes if nothing changes. Ladies and gentlemen, your Chicago Fire. Up to nothing.
I'm still shocked every time. That's on me.
5 minutes, a terrible PK to give away. And then Kevin Prettis just sitting in the middle of the 18-yard box to slot home. Like, it's on.
So I thought DC actually started this game better. Roberto was super dangerous, but couldn't finish. And they were playing straight through that central midfield, because that's what happens a lot of times when Jimenez is in there, because he's good on the ball, but he's not covering ground, and neither is Madrona or whoever else he's partnered with. Couldn't finish. And then Chicago scores a great goal for Jimenez. They go up 2-0, and it felt like DC was dead. And then they fall asleep defensively. Paredes is completely unmarked. And from that moment on, it was a matter of time until DC drew, which is not the way it had to go down. They could have given up that goal and still said, well, we're up 2-1. We're at home. We're going to be able to get this done. Stanislav Ivanov came off the bench, made his debut, which was a nice moment for them. So now they're up 2-1. They get this guy back. Everything looks good. And then Jonathan Bornstein, the one experienced dude on the back line, slide tackle someone going away from goal, away from the center of the field for no reason. It's rough. It is rough.
So that's your Chicago Fire. Slam that shot of Malort out there, folks. New York City FC knocked off Montreal. Montreal, it seemed to me, in the second half, they're gassed. Just didn't have it after that game against Cincinnati. But this is New York City FC. They got a good result, but they didn't get as good a result as they should have gotten. Expected goals, the eye test, the second half where they were just pushing, banging posts. Just couldn't quite run that score up, but they'll take 1-0 against Montreal right now. Ralph Priso looked nice. 18-year-old Canadian central midfielder. 1-1 for Toronto FC, so that was good. And Jefferson Soteldo is an absolute menace. Isolated 1v1. Like, I feel so bad for defenders who look up and are like, oh, crap, this little dude with the blonde hair is about to just embarrass me. He did that a number of times on this one, but it wasn't quite enough. I do look forward to Altidore, Pozuelo, and Soteldo being where Altidore and Pozuelo were when Pozuelo first got there. Like, if they can get there, then everything that Doyle said on this show about them making a run, perhaps into the playoffs, could very well be true.
Also, Oso. Because Tsubasa Endo's fine, and he was fine in this game again. But to have another guy who can come in and link up, because you saw Pozuelo really float wide left to either fill the gaps Soteldo would leave or to create overloads with him. And no one then fills in the middle. There's no one who's a quick option. There's no one who wants the ball under pressure. You add Oso into that, and maybe Richie at right wing back coming forward or right back. That really would change a lot for this team. And we're starting to reach the point where it's like, okay, they're undefeated in three games under Javi Perez, but it's also two home draws. And they're finally actually home. So you need to start hitting that point quickly if you're going to make a playoff run.
Bummer for Kansas City, home draw for them. They have got 17 points from trailing positions this season. That is the most in the league. That's more than anybody had last year. That is not what Peter Vermes would want. They drew against San Jose. Didn't look like they were going to. Had a VAR call that, I still have people yelling in my mentions about this, where Johnny Russell goes down but gets right back up. The play is stopped for PK, but on video review, it's no longer a PK. So now he doesn't have the opportunity to take the shot that he was going to take, and they don't have the PK, but in the
end... He didn't have a chance for a shot. He could have played across,
but
he was not in a shooting position
that's
from that angle.
That's true.
With the defenders around him.
But he's slippery. Maybe he could get there, but play was tough. It was a tough moment for Kansas City, but Daniel Shalloway got his fifth goal in six, I want to say.
Yeah, off Johnny Williams. Unbelievable free kick.
Johnny Williams.
Johnny Russell. Is Derek Williams then?
I got 18 names in my head. You're mashing people together, but...
It should be free kick of the year, even though it didn't go in. He literally cleanly floats that one, curls it over the wall, off the crossbar, bounces down onto the goal line, and then comes out for them to tap in. But I would say you should beat San Jose at home if you're SKC and what you want to do. But with the level that that club is depleted and the energy with which they close that game out with and got the point, I actually think emotionally you come off of it and it doesn't feel like points dropped for KC.
Rapids 2, Dallas 0. This is not good for Dallas, and particularly their road form. This is the away record for Lucha Gonzalez in his term. 4 wins, 23 losses, 6 draws. That's in 3 seasons, and 3 of those 4 wins came in 2019, his first season.
Weeby, I actually think you're a dirty player, so I don't think you deserve any points, and we should
there. That's true. Did we forgot to
Anders
play the Daniel Shalloway clip.
I just set you up.
Not a fan of San Jose. Playing against them, they are playing very dirty football, and I don't think they deserve points ever.
Ever? Literally ever?
Ever?
Yeah,
Dennis Shalloway. That's childish.
He's a little riled up after that one. We won't go in on FC Dallas too hard here, but they've got 7 losses and 7 games on the road this year. They're undefeated at home. Only 2 of those are wins. They're bottom of the Western Conference. Yeah. So as we dump on Miami here, and deservedly so, given their results, you got to acknowledge that Dallas's results are not there. But the Rapids keep climbing. Real Salt Lake, they would have felt like this is a loss.
Mm-hmm. 100%.
LA Galaxy sends Chicharito come back. And Kevin Cabral is not a number 9. We know that. But there's no better goal scorer in MLS right now than Ryan Revolution. This man had he had 12 club goals in 14,000 plus minutes before joining the Galaxy. He has 3 goals in 4 games since getting to MLS.
And I think he was playing center back for 1 or 2 of them as
well.
This
is absurd.
This one was nuts. The run out of midfield and the power and direction on the header was phenomenal. And he had to. Because as you said, Cabral missed an open goal, basically. Doesn't matter if you're a 9 or not.
That's
you're
true.
In that spot. You put it in.
You're a professional
Francier as well wasted a ton of breaks, a ton of opportunities in transition. In a game in which you don't have Chicharito and you don't have Jonas still. So your 2 DPs, those guys needed to step up. They didn't, but Revolution did. And he's been awesome. And I think he also kept this team alive just with Sasha and Victor playing central midfield. Like there are gaps in that midfield to play through. And he covered ground. He protected that back line. I don't know about Derek Williams. Maybe that's why that name was in my head. Like we haven't seen him play well yet for the LA Galaxy.
But 1 win, 1 draw, 1 loss without Chicharito and Jonah during this Gold Cup break so far. That's pretty good. They've been rotating a ton. Greg Vanney has to be happy with that. Bob Riley's not going to be happy about that late goal that the Portland Timbers scored to knock off LAFC. LAFC, I thought, were the better team in this game. I thought they created more dangerous chances. I thought they were on the brink of scoring. And the Timbers just do what the Timbers do. Got Diego Valeri, bang, 2 minutes in. Felipe Mora, bang, at the end of the game, 2-1 win.
But
hugs and go home.
Sebastian Blanco and Felipe Mora come off the bench. And I'm not the biggest fan of Felipe Mora, but the guy plays for Chile. Like that's what Portland has.
The header was majestic.
Yeah. And very few, if any MLS teams have that, is depth of that quality to bring in, including not having an Eric Williamson. You're missing your starting fullback with the Argentine Olympic team, which is the number one international competition on the planet. Like, there's a lot of quality missing, and they still have a ton of depth, and they are able to hang in games and then come back and get those opportunities. For LAFC, it was a bit of a weakened team. And as you said, they were still super aggressive and all over the place. Now let's see what a center forward can add to that team.
Yeah, let's do see. We'll talk to Tom Bogert about that in just a second. And Felipe Cardenas is coming up to explain what's going on in Atlanta. They drew 1-1 in Cincinnati. They come back home this weekend on ABC against Columbus. You can watch that on Saturday afternoon. Again, on ABC, Saturday afternoon, Atlanta United, Columbus. We have some mail here about the coaching search. Dave, you want to run us through that real quick, and then we'll bring Felipe on?
Yeah, it's interesting. Atlanta's a new club, and so they don't have that many club legends that go back, and yet we got a ton of emails asking for club legends to coach. So the first one is, personally, I'd love to see Jeff Lorenowitz as coach of Atlanta, a man who knows the city, the culture, the league, a born leader, beloved by all, would look amazing in a suit on the sideline and still ready to choke slam anyone at a moment's notice in the name of Atlanta United. Could something like this be possible? And then Tom Cooper emailed in and said Atlanta fans would be happy if a Michael Parkhurst were to take over. We talked about Landon Donovan on the last show. Biggest issue is he does not have a coaching license, but maybe a fallback if Tata starts doing better in Mexico. Love the show. We also got an email from Jared who said Stone Mountain, Georgia native Josh Wolf should be an option. Obviously, he has a job.
Yeah.
So it's kind of hard.
Yeah, I don't think, look, I think you're maybe going to give up on that one, Jared, in Stone Mountain. Josh Wolf ain't coming, man. He's not coming to save this day. I did enjoy that the guy who hit us up about Jeff Lorenowitz is Sourpuss Strike, which is interesting. Probably a lot of sourpusses in Atlanta right now, given the results and what's happening with the club. Let's talk to Felipe Cardenas. It's AT&T 5G call to the field. It's an AT&T 5G call to the field, and we are calling Felipe Cardenas of The Athletic because he is very busy, and we are not the only ones, I assume, calling you, Felipe. How has your week been, man? Calm, chill, really relaxed?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, just normal work week for me, of course. No, it's been wild. It's been crazy. I think it's been – anyone that's in Atlanta has been doing a lot of work. Clearly, as you guys know, like ever since really the Joseph Martinez thing started happening with Gabriel Hines, I've been on top of it in a – I don't think the story has ended quite yet, to be honest with you guys.
All right. So how did this story start? Let's begin there for you. When did you start getting an inkling that something was off in Five Stripes world? Because from my perspective, at least, this seemed to happen pretty darn quickly.
Yeah, I mean, I think when I go back, I do the timeline. I point to July 6th when it was the first time that Gabriel Hines publicly told us that Joseph Martinez was training separate from the team. And so at the first, I admit, like, I think all of us assume that he was coming back into fitness after World Cup qualifying and having to have gone through COVID in Brazil during the Copa America. But from then, like, that's when my sources started to kind of contact me, and I started to kind of look into what was happening with Joseph because he wasn't back. And now in hindsight, when we would ask players during availabilities, like, what's this going to be like when Joseph comes back? Are you guys anxious? Like, they would literally, like, not know how to answer. And it's because I don't think they knew what was going on. And that seemed to have been intentional on Gabriel Heinze's part. And so then I realized through sources that Joseph Martinez had been medically cleared to play about 5 days after returning from Copa America. So clearly this was not a fitness issue. The next time we got Gabriel Heinze, I had to ask him straight up, like, what is going on with Joseph Martinez? And knowing that he's, you know, I think in the end, I wasn't sure what he was going to say, but now knowing him, Gabriel Heinze, he's very transparent and was just blunt. He's like, it's a coach's decision. Has nothing to do with fitness, and he has his reasons, and he wouldn't elaborate. And so that's when I knew something was going terribly wrong within Atlanta United. You have a new coach, a very strong-minded, unorthodox sort of coach that has now is feuding with another strong, very strong personality and one of the best players that this league has seen. And a team, you know, player that is beloved by the city, that is sort of like the face of the franchise, that drives a lot of money every to these weekly games, merchandise. Like, it was like this problem that I saw happening. And that's when these problems really started, up until the last game against New England on Saturday. That was the eighth game without a win for Atlanta United. The next day, Gerber Heinze was let go.
Do we think if they had been winning, but Joseph was not training with the team and all this stuff was going on, that Gerber Heinze would still be the manager?
You know, I think it would have been perhaps more difficult for the club to make this decision. Carlos Bocanegra, the technical director, and the president, Darren Eales, told us on Sunday that it wasn't performance-based. But even though they weren't winning games and they're 10th in the East, they referred to it as a variety of issues that centered more around like leadership. So that to me sounds like it's there's something else there. Through a lot of reporting, throughout the country, especially locally here, we know now that there was an MLSPA grievance filed. There were players that were overtraining. They were crossing the threshold of the hours that are established to be able to train in preseason. It all happened really early. Like, we're here in July, but these things were happening months ago. And so I think that was probably where the club was going as far as the decision to let this coach go. But I believe, the Joseph thing didn't help. The losses don't help. And the fact that you have a team that just didn't look good on game day, like it just wasn't working really, that the whole package.
How do they come to that moment? Because this is not, this is not started July 6th. This started basically years ago when Tata left and Frank DeBoer came in, and that worked for a little while, and then it didn't work, and then he was gone, and then we went through a whole coaching search, and we were here with you talking through those candidates and the process, and now we are here back again. Like, how bad does it have to be for Atlanta United to can their new, shiny, we did it, we got the right guy head coach 13 games into a season? Like, we've heard all the stuff, Doug McIntyre's reporting, your reporting, all throughout about all the different things going on. How bad was it?
I don't think we know yet, but it's bad. It's not just on the coach. There are decision makers here that are responsible. Like you said, they set their sights on Gerber Heinze, a 6-month courtship where he was the only candidate. They put everything in, on Gerber Heinze to be the coach that got them, that would get them out of this funk from the 2020 season that was a disaster. They had to fire Frank DeBoer. They don't make the playoffs. The team just looks like a regular sort of run-of-the-mill MLS club coming from the Tata years. Now, you mentioned it, Andrew. It's like, this is the first time they've had a coach that has hard training methods and who's had to who was approached by players like, hey, we have a CBA. This is what we've fought for. Mm-hmm. That happened under Tata Martino. There was not a grievance filed, from what my sources tell me. It was like more like a warning, but it was to the point where the players were concerned. And the club, the union, the players, and Tata Martino dealt with it. They had injuries, but they dealt with that. The coach adjusted. He had a staff that understood how to deal with this sort of situation, what battles to pick with players, with the front office, with everything, and it led to incredible success. And so the drop-off has been severe. And, I think with Heinze, who was supposed to kind of bring back the glory, I even wrote about that. Like, I felt like it was a great hire for MLS. I think now in hindsight, my caveat throughout my reporting from the day he was announced was always like, will this work in this present moment for Atlanta United? Are they able to truly harness and manage a coach like this, who has all of his mentors, perhaps like flaws in Marcelo Bielsa? He is that sort of coach, as far as how he controls players psychologically, how he manages club staff, and how he takes over when he steps into a job. And so I don't think that was managed well internally, because if you're a sporting director and if you're a president, if you're making this hire, you need to be there day to day and be able to understand where this coach and his staff, who are new to the country, new to the league, may find their missteps. And very interesting, I felt, after that loss to New England last Saturday, Gerber Heinze, when he was asked if he had the backing of the front office, his answer was like, I don't need their backing. Like, they are alongside me every single day. They see me work. They've seen, I told them what I was going to do. You know, there weren't surprises. And so I thought that was revealing. I think it was sort of intentional on his part as well, but there shouldn't have been, you know, this, whoa, we didn't know what we were getting into. If you went down to Argentina, like Carlos Bocanegra said, I'm sure they told them, okay, this is what you're committing to, this sort of coach, this sort of personality, these demands, but these are the results that you may have, which in the last few years for Heinz have been pretty good.
You cover the connection, the strongest it's probably ever been between South America and MLS over the last few years. I'm just curious, is this an indictment right now at this time on Argentine managers in MLS? When you look at GBS last year, what happened with Heinz? I think different people have different opinions about how Matias Almeida is doing. And obviously he had the stop off in Chivas along the way. Are these just individuals and they've each had their own moment? Because obviously their struggles are completely different in the way it's happened. Or do you see something bigger in managers coming from specifically Argentina to MLS?
It's a good question. I think it's a valid debate. I don't think it should be down to nationality, though. You know, I think clearly because, first of all, like the most successful coach in Atlanta United history is an Argentine. Like I mentioned, his staff was made up of all Argentines, aside from the goalkeeper coach, who is now with the U.S. men's national team, Aaron Hyde. That was a very important hire as well. But that's what I'm saying. It was like they knew how to find that, like the right formula. So it's not so much the country. I do think it's a cultural thing. I think the fit has to be right. You know, the project has to be right for these coaches like Matias Almeida. You know, is that the right project for him? You know, we've been talking about that since he came in. You know, it's much different to be coaching at Chivas than to be coaching at San Jose. And that goes down to not just like the investment that you get at these clubs, but like the talent that is available within the academies, the sort of players that you can, you know, cover band-aids, like wounds with band-aids. Oh, I need a youth player that's going to start. Great. I can go down and do that. That's what Heinze had at Vélez too. Oh, this player's hurt. I'll go down to the academy and I'm going to play an 18-year-old that can just rip it on the wings. You know, that's not the case in MLS, certainly not the case in Atlanta United. And so, yes, like the way I reported it recently, it's like maybe it puts a pause on going all in on an international manager, but only because Atlanta United is 13 games into a season. And if they're going to bring in an international manager, I think they need to like package that deal differently and perhaps have assistants that understand the league, that understand what it's going to take to get to the playoffs at this moment in time, how to study the opponents. Like for hindsight, he said it himself. It was like he was learning about, you know, the Portland Timbers. He was learning about how to face New England and Montreal. Like it was all sort of this thing that, but if you're committing to that, like that's because it was like a 2-year project. And so I don't think it's necessarily an indictment on South American coaches. I do think that there is something there about like, what does the word fit truly mean, honestly?
And how do you support somebody once you bring them into your organization, perhaps? I want to get to you on the process of all this, of the hire itself, but more importantly, the next hire and who might be targets for that, what the timeline might be. But I do have to ask you here, because, and I don't know if it's reporting or rumor mongering or just bad translations going back and forth. Of course, Heinz and his camp are going to come out and say, hey, this didn't go down the right way. Are there two sides to this? Like it seems in the reporting so far that it's been sort of, I don't know if one-sided is the right word. I'm not trying to target you or anybody else with that. I'm just saying that Heinz has sort of been portrayed as the bad guy. Yeah. Were there players that truly supported him and believed him? Is there a large part of the squad that did? Like, was there a split within the team as it came to how they were managed and then this decision that was made by Atlanta United?
Yeah, I mean, I think from my reporting and when I've been talking to sources this whole week, I think my consensus is that it does seem like a little bit of a split down the middle as far as how that locker room viewed Gabriel Heinze. You know, it wasn't like it was a full on mutiny. Like, I don't think that's accurate at all. There were players that supported him. You know, Brooks Lennon on Monday, like I think he gave this quote that I include in the story, like he was surprised by the fire. He gave Heinze like a lot of credit for having given him the like more responsibility on this team. Like honestly, Brooks Lennon has been really good this year. You know,
he might be the best player on this team.
Yeah. And I think a lot of it has to do with the sort of the individual coaching that he got from Gabriel Heinze. And so I also know from talking to sources that, yeah, other players were had a difficult time, you know, adjusting to the training regimen. I think sort of like the mental demands and also just tactically, it wasn't, it's sometimes it's not fun to play that way sometimes when you're constantly like on an island, you know, getting ripped to shreds up the middle. You're trying to man mark a guy. You had George Bello playing as a left back, and sometimes he was on the opposite side of the field chasing somebody. And just like in the end, I was like, what are these guys doing? You know, like it wasn't cohesive. And that I think that frustrates, honestly, like experienced players, you know, players that have been on winning teams and they see the way this is going tactically and they're like, you know, this is not working. And so it's not full on mutiny. I think that's what Heinz's camp, that's why they came out to say, to kind of refute very specifically Doug McIntyre's report about the water thing. Like I took it to the next level. Like I wanted to find out like what really happened with the limitation of water. I was able to find out that he was mimicking, you know, match day access to water. It was perhaps not a plan that was well thought out, and they ended it. You know, like it wasn't this ongoing thing. And so I think that is where Heinz's camp is coming. And again, like no one looks good in this situation.
No.
I mean, no one does. Like that's how grave of a situation it is for Atlanta United that, you know, the coach of course is upset because this is not what he expected. But everyone at the club, I think, even the players that have been given everything on the field, though, but no one really looks good, especially the front office, who once again has put themselves in this situation to have to find a new coach.
So for Atlanta United fans watching, this is now the third time in 2 years that they're watching this club go through this. And you said no one looks good. Most of the people besides Heinze are still the same people that we've seen go through this process before. What, if anything, makes you think this time will be different or more successful?
I don't know truly, you know, because it's not like we're at the end of the season and the coach is moving on because he got a different job and they were successful. And now there's like sort of a continuation of something. You know, I tweeted it yesterday because it came from Carlos Bocanegra when I had a conversation with him in the summer of 2019. Like he said that this club is constantly succession planning. Like, I don't see that. Like succession means consistent results and a plan so that when this coach leaves, this is the sort of coach that's coming in. When this player leaves, we're bringing in this sort of player. As the tactics evolve, these are the sorts of profiles that we need. And like so far, everything has not been that way. And so now they're looking for a coach 13 games into the season, and it's difficult to have the right answer here. You know, is it an MLS experienced coach? Well, do you want this job? Like, do you want this job right now? Like in the situation that you're in, is it an international coach? Does an international coach want to come in? Does the club want to then manage? We need to get him in. We need to work on the visa situation. We need to get him settled. We need to get his staff in place. Like all these things that they're going to have to juggle and ultimately make a decision about, like, okay, this is where we are right now. We need to be in the playoffs. Carlos Bocanegra told us that on Sunday, that the goal is the playoffs, which in my opinion, you know, if this is a super club, as Alexi Lalas continues to say, I disagree. A super club is a club that wins consistently, that develops players consistently. They may have begun as that, but they're not there anymore. And now you have a technical director saying that the goal is the playoffs, when the goal used to be to win every trophy that they were competing for. And so the standard has dipped a lot. And that's where this hire is coming into. Like, they need the hire to be able to just lift the bar a little bit, get into the playoffs, and then set the standard again. And that's just like a difficult process, I think, right now for Atlanta.
What's the timeline on this, do you think? It doesn't feel to me like you could afford to or should or will rush. Like, yes, you have whatever 20 something games to get to the playoffs, but Rob Valentino, my guy, but pat you on the back, give you a pat on the butt, get out there and fix this thing, man, get the vibes right, and we'll figure it out on the back end. But there's a huge amount of pressure on Darren and Carlos to fix it on the back end. What do you think of the timeline?
Yeah, it's tough. You know, Darren Eel said he wants to do a quick hire, which it seems like, I don't know if that's the right idea. Like, again, they have very difficult jobs, like to begin with, like the front office members, but like they want to make a quick hire. And I think it's because they can't afford to punt on this season. They can't just say, hey, well, we're going to roll with Valentino and like whatever happens, happens, we'll regroup, which is what happened last year with Stephen Glass. It was like they were lucky to have Stephen Glass. He's a very good coach, but I don't think they were expecting to truly climb the table and make this incredible run. Now they have to, because they can't afford to have another year like that. You know, you guys said it, I think it was a tweet that like, you know, Ronald Hernandez, like, God bless him. He's had a tough few years to get today. He's been playing really well, scored a great goal in Copa America, but Atlanta celebrating a tie against FC Cincinnati, I think, tells the story of where this club is. And yes, the players perform well. They played for their new manager, because that's what players do when the interim manager steps in. They want to play for him. But that should not, again, that should not be the standard of Atlanta United, to tie FC Cincinnati and celebrate like that. So yeah, they want to make a quick hire. It'll be interesting to see if they stick to that and if that's the right decision. I think we will collectively probably debate that once it's done.
I know, obviously, we started this with the Joseph Martinez stuff. He did some media this week, returned against FC Cincinnati. His contract, I believe, ends at the end of the 2023 season. Is he a long-term Atlanta United player?
For now, he is. You know, my sources were pretty adamant about the, I guess you can call it a threat, that he told the front office that he wanted out, you know, after this year. He, you know, clearly he was at odds with the coach. I think he was disappointed with the project as well. It's not just, I don't like this coach, get me out of here. It's like, where are my boys? You know, look around. Joseph Martinez doesn't see the talent that he used to have. He comes off a really bad injury and he comes back to this. And so I think that's where the frustration was coming, according to my sources on that. Now, yes, he has a contract up until 2023. He revealed that again publicly, that he wants to be here. He wants to retire here. He loves this club. He loves the city. I think he is very genuine in saying that. That does not mean that he will end up retiring in Atlanta. And it's
comes with caveats, it sounds like. I mean, right. As it always will. Like, it's his career, his pathway. He wants to win. He didn't sign on to... He signed on in the wake of like glory, not to have it all slip away.
Exactly. And something that when I asked him the other day, you know, how much change can an organization truly withstand before you fall into sort of troubling times? And this is a guy that was here when there was no facility. And he said it when I told him, like, hey, you were here before there's even a training pitch. And he was like, I was here before there were bathrooms. And so that's Joseph Martinez. He is the
club specific memory.
So he was like very specific in that, like, I've been here, I've seen the growth. He mentioned the bad, like the decisions that have not worked out. I think that was interesting to hear from a player of his caliber. Like, there are decisions that haven't been worked out. But you know, we need to get back to winning. All the players need to commit. And so, yeah, to your point, Andrew, I think it's like a player in his position, you know, it's again, debatable where his value is right now, but clearly he's like extremely valuable to the league, to the city, and to Atlanta United. And so I think for as long as the long-term plan for Joseph, I think the project needs to be better. And like, I guess you could argue, well, this is what happens when you put all your eggs into one basket on Joseph, a player like him, but like, he's scored almost 100 goals, man. I mean, it's like,
oh, by the way, there are millions of eggs in other baskets too.
Yeah. Yeah.
Different kind of eggs. So
we'll see. I mean, Joseph, I think for now, I think he wants to stay. He wants to stay. It looks like he wants to stay. But it's everything we've talked about up until this point, it's like so many things are up in the air. It's difficult to see who is going to be around moving forward.
From MLS Cup to chaos. That's what I keep thinking with Atlanta United right now. You're right, Felipe. This is not a super club in MLS terms or in any terms right now. And that's on the front office to go out and try to return them to those days of glory. Follow him on Twitter, Felipe Carr, C-A-R at the end, not full name, at The Athletic as well. Best money I spend every single month outside of ESPN Plus. Felipe, thanks for your time, man.
Thanks, guys. Anytime. Happy to be on.
All right. Thanks to Felipe for guiding us through Atlanta United. But now we move on to our number one Ace Ventura pet detective of transfers for our AT&T 5G interview, Tom Bogart.
Thank you very much. I like the Ace Ventura reference there. I'll take that.
I think Ace would have worn that shirt.
I think so, too. I was Ace Ventura for Halloween 1 year in college, so I feel like this worked well.
Gotcha. With that shirt or a different one? Just confirming.
Different one. Oh, but I have a lot. Oh, man. The arsenal's expanding.
Oh, my. You have a lot of knowledge.
We're here.
On the transfer front, also, Anders is making a good note here. It's an AT&T 5G call to the field. Let's talk transfers, Tom. Let's talk LAFC. We've been asking about center forward for a while now. Brian Rodriguez is back. That also meant that they didn't have a DP spot. It seems they've gone out and gotten a TAM guy in Christian Arango. Fill us in on who he is and what this deal is all about.
Yeah, Christian Arango is LAFC are nearing their first major signing of the summer. He's a Colombian center forward. He's 26 years old. He has, 22 goals and 6 assists in the past couple of years with Millonarios in Colombia. He's a guy who's went to Europe a couple times and didn't quite work out. In his teenage years, he went with Valencia. He performed pretty well for their B team based on, the stats that I've read. But he never kind of cracked the first team, came back to Colombia, impressed again, got a chance with Benfica, but kind of how they have a big squad where they loan guys out and it's not so easy to crack their first team. He didn't. And he came back to Millonarios and he's impressed again. He kind of picked up right where he left off. So LAFC kind of came in. The deal will be around 2.5 million when it gets over the line. I'm told that it wasn't 100% done, but it seemed like a foregone conclusion that one was going to get done and announced soon. Maybe before this podcast drops, we'll see. But yeah, he's a center forward. His secondary position is kind of second striker, so he's not one of those guys that can play on the wing necessarily, unless that LAFC see him differently. But it should allow LAFC more flexibility to go back to their 4-3-3, the Bob Bradley bread and butter that they've played so successfully in the first few years, to move away from, Rossi and Vela kind of playing as two false nines. And he's just, another guy in that Colombian market that they have, mined so successfully with Eddie Segura, Edward Atuesta, and Jesus Murillo.
You got Juan Pablo Angel doing his diligence.
So can I ask, them going out and signing a TAM center forward, does that mean there's no expectation that the third DP spot will be available to them this transfer window?
Just kind of reading between the lines, I think that it'd be wishful thinking that an acceptable offer is going to come in for Brian Rodriguez. When he was coming back from his loan in Spain and then going to the Copa America, it was always, we will love him to come back if he comes back. But hey, if there's an option, if something happens. It wasn't exactly a vote of confidence in, no, we want this guy back, we want to rebuild his value or whatever. It was, if something comes up. Hey, if not, we'd love for him to come back. So,
okay, somebody drop a bag of money on
my
our table.
Yeah, my assumption is there isn't exactly a huge burgeoning market for Brian Rodriguez at the moment.
All right, LAFC, interesting signing from them. They're starting to rise, starting to have better results. Carlos Vela is looking better. Sporting KC, top of the West, though. We're close to it. They got Seattle this weekend on ESPN Plus, MLS Live. Busio! And everybody says something different, but they're all saying Venezia is the destination, and it's basically done. We don't have the release yet or the official word from Sporting Kansas City, and of course we got to wait on that. But I trust the folks reporting it. Fabrizio Romano, you got Taylor Twellman diving in, and one Tom Bogert is saying it as well. Where does the Gianluca Busio situation stand?
Yeah, this one's done pending a medical. That's the only thing. That's all that's left, and that will happen after the Gold Cup. So you won't get an official announcement, I don't think, for a while, unless that these teams want to just kind of put the speculation in bed and release it as pending a medical or whatever. But yeah, that deal's done. He's Venice bound. He's going to go to Venezia FC if all things go well here. And yeah, so Twellman reported that the deal is up to $11 million with incentives, and Fabrizio reported that it starts at around $5 million US. So that's, again, that's all I've heard too. I can't necessarily confirm it, but I wouldn't deny that. I'd say that those two guys have great reputations. You should believe that. And that's a huge figure for SKC if they can get up to 11. And again, Twellman said that the add-ons are attainable. So that would be just a wonderful piece of business for Kansas City.
And he said he's seen the documents there. So that's where Taylor's coming from on that one. But that's a pretty big swath there, Dave, right? Between like the initial starting point and the end point, like they're betting big on Gianluca Busio to overperform or at least perform up to the standard that these contracts are laying out.
Yeah, and I think the other piece was you're looking at sell-ons, right? So for SKC, just to get him into Serie A, you're looking at more money down the line than what the initial deal is. And it's one of the things I think we don't do a great job talking about is it's not just that first sale. It's the run as they go along their time in Europe. And I think for SKC, they learn from the Eric Palmer Brown situation. They see his value at a highest level we've seen so far. It could still go up, but it could also drop based on performances. So you get him into the U.S. camp. He had a strong, I think, last 6 months. Now's a good time to sell and sell to a place where he'll play so that he can then continue to grow his value.
What a GM.
A couple more notes on that. One is I expect there to be some sort of relegation release clause. That's not something I can confirm, but that was something that was being talked about. So if they do go down, he kind of won't be stuck. And two, that sell on only kicks in after the fee that Venezia pays is recouped. So that 20% comes in after, say, $11 million or whatever, if the incentives are reached. So this one isn't as much about that second sale because it might be difficult to bank on them selling him for, you know, 25 or 30 million. I suppose it's in the cards if he kind of reaches his potential and everything that we think about his talent. But if you get 11 million, if all these incentives are hit, that's great business as is. You don't need to worry about kind of that second one. This isn't like the Reggie Cannon deal where it was, you know, around 3.5 million plus a sell on. They're really banking on the sell on. This one is okay. We got the bag up front and anything else that comes, it's, you know,
that's well done by Kansas City. How much do GMs and technical directors and folks around the league, how important are those sell ons? It's right. We haven't done a great job of sort of driving home that this is a long-term play, these transfers.
It's absolutely integral. Look at the deals that Philly did with McKenzie and Aronson. They got a lot of money up front and they demanded having sell-ons. FC Dallas, every player they've sold, and, you know, I've talked to Andre Zanotto about this on the record. He's like, yeah, we won't do a deal without a sell-on, you know, unless that somebody's going to be like, really, really put a huge offer in front of us. This is something that we need and this is something that we're going to bank on. I've talked to other GMs around the league that they kind of view it the same. And they view the numbers as important. You look at, obviously, it'd probably be better in the, you know, the short run. Okay, we the bigger the sell-on, the better. But if you have a 50% sell-on, what incentive does that show to the next club to sell him? And you're looking at it with Eric Williamson in Portland right now. You know, DC United have a 50% sell-on. What number would make sense for Portland to sell Eric Williamson for if they're only getting half of that cut? So, and like Sam Vines, like when he goes to Royal Antwerp, if that was 50%, what incentive would Royal Antwerp have to sell him? How big would that fee have to be? So the bigger the fee, you kind of play yourself out of that next transfer. So, you know, like the 20 to 30% is kind of the sweet spot that most clubs are looking for.
Sam Vines, is he going? Seems like he's going. Maybe that's another situation where the medical is an issue. What do you know about that one?
Yeah, that one's on the verge of happening. It's almost done with Royal Antwerp. Like you said, you know, they need to do the medical and the Athletic. The good guys at the Athletic reported that deal is worth up to $2 million. It feels, you know, slightly low for someone of Vines's experience and pedigree so far with the national team in Colorado. But, you know, look, you look at what Dallas had to do. You kind of climb the monkey bars with deal after deal, and Vines would be kind of the first one that Colorado sold. So instead of where Dallas was able to sell Brian Reynolds for upwards of $8.5 million or whatever it kind of ended up being, they could point to Cannon and McKinney, Richards, all these. Like, this is a Rapids proof of concept. You know, Vines is going to be the first one to go. So they have, you know, a very healthy sell on in him too. And they understand that they're not going to get, you know, $5 million offer for a left back right out of the gate. So they're kind of banking on this one being their proof of concept that, you know, lays the groundwork for things moving forward.
And I like this. I like this move for both sides. I think, yeah, as Tom said, Colorado, they just gave more homegrowns debuts this week. They need to get into this process. And for Sam Vines, I think he's super solid. I don't know that he's going to blow anyone away, but put him in other environments for him to show that he can succeed there, right? So if he goes and plays well, now you can say, well, he scaled his game to a new level. He scaled his game, I think, to the international level pretty well so far. Not maybe at the elite international level, but at least at a CONCACAF level. And so get him out there and just get him that experience. I'll miss watching him in MLS, obviously, but I think this one is one of those where it makes sense for all parties involved.
And Royal Antwerp in Belgium is a good spot to start and jump from. Right. And if you have that proof of concept, if he overperforms the fee, then let's say when somebody like Cole Bassett comes around and people come sniffing, you can say, look, do you believe he's going to translate? Well, look at Sam Vines. He's translating. And this guy might have been an even bigger part of our team. Cole Bassett. It seems like there was sort of a rush on Bundesliga interest, or reported, I think you reported that Freiburg were in for him. Where does he stand right now as far as his future, whether it be in MLS or in Europe?
So that's the thing. They might not even be able to wait for Vines to have appearances in Europe. You know, this market's pretty hot right now. There have been offers on the table. There have been offers rejected. Even speaking to people in Colorado, they have a difficulty kind of getting acceptable offers and respectable offers kind of up front, because teams think, okay, you don't have proof of concept. Oh, this player's done this. He's always on with that. Will the goals translate to other leagues? Whatever. So there hadn't been anything early that was acceptable or even respectable. Like, I had heard stuff wasn't even hitting $1 million on a player like that, which kind of shocked me. And I'm sure that the club and the agents kind of left like that. That's not going to be something that's going to get that deal done. But yeah, there's a big market for him. There had been offers in, you know, Germany, Holland. There's a ton of interest kind of in that area, Germany, Holland, Belgium. I think this one's a matter of time. I don't know if it happens right now or not, but he's definitely somebody with a ton of suitors.
What we talk about this show all the time, and Doyle and I are talking about Twitter Spaces on Tuesday, where like every team we hit, or it feels like it, has a young player or a player, or a player's moving or a transfer's done, or there's real rumors, or it just feels like the ground is shifting under our feet every single day, and that this league is changing big time as far as it goes, like a transfer market goes for overseas clubs. What are GMs saying to you about this? Because it has to be a huge shift for them as well.
Yeah, it's just kind of the evolution of the league and the evolution of thinking. And that comes from both people who have been around the league forever and they're kind of, you know, changing as the league changes and newer people coming in. Like, this is how it works everywhere else in the world. And there are a lot of people with experience everywhere else in the world that this is secondhand nature. Like, going back to Andre Zanota in Dallas, he's like, he worked for Gremio. He worked for Sao Paulo. He was involved in the Neymar deal when he first went to Barcelona. Like, that's just what they do. So when he kind of came to Dallas, he thought that was, you know, the perfect fit for him because, hey, this is what Dallas does. And you get more and more people in the league like that. It helps change the tide. It helps the minority become the majority. And teams realizing that this is, one, how you got to, you know, succeed and fit into the global transfer market. And two, this is financially beneficial. And this helps pay for the academy and great investments in the academy. This helps pay for your next imports. And then you kind of just slowly, again, using the monkey bar analogy, again, you go one rung at a time and you move up and up. And instead of buying a kid from South America for $500,000, the next time you buy him for $1 million and then two. And then that's how you get greater and greater talent and greater investment.
So I wanted to ask, because you mentioned, we talked about Cole Bassett. I think we're going to talk about Tejan Buchanan as well. We talk about it in abstract all the time. I don't believe either of them have European passports. So what's the process in getting them, making them available to a European club and having the opportunity to play? Bassett, not really. With national team call-ups, obviously Tejan has started to get them.
Yeah, I mean, with Bassett, he went on a training stint with the Arsenal U23s and kind of a few people I talked to were convinced that there was at least going to be an offer from Arsenal's youth side about getting him in their system if there was any chance that he could have gotten a work permit, which this was, you know, a few years ago, and he was far further away from the national team, and it was even harder than it is now to get a work permit. England, United Kingdom, that's notoriously very difficult, so I'm not going to set them aside. But there are places like, you know, Germany, Holland, Belgium, like they don't have restrictive, you know, work permit rules. So it's easier for, and again, that's why you see so many MLSers landing in, you know, those countries, and particularly Germany. Italy is, you know, not necessarily like those guys would be able to get there and play and be able to be registered, but every team only gets two non-EU spots per season. So if you're buying one of them, they have to be ready to contribute in the first team level. So that's kind of the difficulties there. But that's, again, this is why you see so much interest from German, Dutch, and Belgian clubs in the MLS market, because it's just much easier for them to, you know, register them to the team.
Speaking of those clubs, maybe in for Tejan, maybe from France as well. His value is just skyrocketing, it seems like. And the interest is as well. What have you heard on him?
Yeah, it really sparked when he excelled at that right back role in the playoffs last year. A lot of teams, you know, thought he was fine as a winger, but then they saw him kind of explode as a right back, a right wing back. And now with Canada, he can play on the left side. That's where his value is. And that's where teams see him as kind of a modern attacking wing back or somebody who could still play on the wing. But he's somebody who they really see kind of at that, you know, wing back role. And he's somebody who can play on either side. His athletic profile, you know, it was really exciting to teams the way his ability in 1v1 going forward. I'm sure he's got to improve his defensive chops, but again, he just started playing, you know, wing back recently, you know, at the end of last season, and he's somebody for club level. He's mostly still playing as a winger. So there are a ton of teams that are interested. There are a ton of teams that see that talent and think we can mold him and we can kind of take him. You know, there was offers from Lens in France. I was told that was around like €3.5 million. And that wasn't anywhere near that New England were kind of looking for. I'm certain that there are going to be more offers coming. I was told that there's a Champions League level club and a couple Bundesliga clubs that are super interested and kind of starting talks and trying to figure out what that market is and what that offer would have to be. I don't know if he goes this summer or not. That would be a difficult sell to Bruce Arena and a team that's currently top of the East to kind of lose a player like that. But look, if somebody drops a bag in front of him, it'd be pretty tough to, you know, deny it. But I think that he'll kind of be this next, you know, big transfer saga to watch after Buzio's done.
So,
go ahead.
I was just going to ask, We've seen it with Red Bulls, which is unique, obviously, because they're the same club.
Mm-hmm.
There's probably a low possibility that the Revs sell Tejan and he stays for the rest of the season, right? Like, the idea would be the sale will occur in January and he would leave in January. Or is there a chance that they make the sale official in July and August, but he stays with the club?
Yeah, honestly, I have no idea. I don't know if talks have really gotten that far yet with any of these teams. We're kind of in the preliminary, you know, stages of this, you know, outside of the Lens offer that again, it was something that wasn't really close to where they value him at. So yeah, I don't know what their plans is. I'm sure in a perfect world, they would like to keep him the same way that in a perfect world, SKC would have liked to keep Busio for the rest of the season. But like, if teams are dropping and going back to the Busio deal up to $10.5 million, if teams are dropping that kind of price, you know, they want him right now and they want him in preseason. And a team like Red Bull Salzburg with Aaronson, one, there was a relationship with Ernst Tanner who had previously worked for Salzburg. Plus, they weren't exactly worried about losing points early right. in the season.
They won the title.
Yeah. And they had Szoboszlai, who was staying with the team until the winter. So they were like, okay, we have this Hungarian wonder kid for the first half of the season. Yeah, just give us Brendan in January, whatever. We'll already have wrapped up the league by then, I'm sure, anyway. So, yeah, it just kind of depends on situation. And I'm sure in a perfect world, they'd love to keep him for the season if something like that happens. But it's too early to tell.
All right, let's finish off with a guy who has already made his decision. That's Chris Mueller. Orlando City came out yesterday and said, look, he's already signed a pre-contract agreement. And now the news is that it's Hibs. Third place in the Scottish Premier League last year. I mean, third place in Scotland. They were 40 points behind Rangers. So there's like there's a big variable here as far as places in the tables go. But he signed the pre-contract. Things didn't work out with Orlando City. You thought they might re-sign him. Oscar, I mean, every time I hear Oscar talk about him, he talks in glowing terms. Why didn't something get done here? And why did Mueller decide Europe's the place for me?
So he, coming into this year after last season, obviously it was known that he was hitting the last year of his contract, and the club and his representatives, they opened conversations. But the last I heard around the winter is that they really weren't close in their valuations. And with his contract getting closer, there's no urgency for, you know, the player side to kind of bend or move on this. They were going to be able to test the open market. And when he's somebody who would be signed on, you know, on a free contract as he is with Hibs, you know, after his contract expires, there's going to be just a ton of interest. So it would have been silly if they kind of accepted a lot less than they thought. And that made it, you know, difficult for Orlando negotiations. And Orlando put out in their release last night announcing that, you know, Mueller would be departing after the season. They made a point in their two paragraph release to say, we have submitted multiple contract offers to Chris kind of over the year. You know, there's no animosity, but they kind of were making it a point to at least say to the fans, look, we were trying to keep him and it just didn't work out.
What do you think of that move, Dave?
I think the whole thing ended fairly awkward, but when you look at it, Orlando knew it was a possibility. So they bring Van der Water in, who yep. they tried to bring in last year. So he's looking at it and saying, one, obviously I can't go to a different MLS club. Like my one option is to negotiate here with Orlando. They're already bringing in a replacement for me. He has lost playing time because of that, and because they're pretty loaded on those wing positions. And so I think he looks at it and says, well, even if it's a similar offer, let's take that risk. Let's go to Europe. Let's see how I can build myself up. He's going to be 25 at the end of the summer. It's now or never with that opportunity for him. And I think he looks at the national team. And yeah, if he kills it in Orlando, there's still a ton of possibility to move into that. But if he goes to Europe and moves his way up the ladder in Europe, I think that's not an easier road to it, but a more obvious yeah. road to getting some minutes in those spots over a Jordan Morris or Paul Arriola. Or whatever it is. So I'm not shocked by it. The longer no deal happened, the more likely this mm-hmm. team yeah. because mm-hmm. once he can go and sign a pre-contract, which means they don't have to pay a transfer fee, now that number can jump a little for the club signing him. Yep. It felt like it was coming for a while.
It'll be interesting to me to see how much playing time he gets the rest of the year. Mm-hmm. I understand the pre-contract. I understand why he would do that. But part of me says if I'm Orlando and I see all this coming, I'm asking for just like a nominal fee.
Yeah.
He can help your team the rest of the way, but as you said, Dave, it gets a little bit awkward, and you have depth. You have other guys that can move in that position. I know that their goal is MLS Cup. It should be, given the roster they built. But if I'm Chris, I might be saying, hey, take a couple hundred grand for me, or hey, or less, whatever it is, whatever the fee is. You get something, I get something, we all get a fresh start on this. That's not what happened. We'll see how it plays out.
Don't you think that's why the statement came out? I think that's part of this process. Is to announce sure. to their fans that right. they've signed this player and he could be available to you, but something's standing in the way. We haven't seen clubs say this all the good time. Point. and the way they said it, right? Orlando was quick to be the ones to come out.
And yeah, they were the ones who announced it, not Hibs. It was them who announced it first, not Hibs.
So,
hey, if you want them earlier, we're right here. You got
we'll
our
We'll take Chris. He can come to ETR.
Get us on Cash App, man.
I love Chris Wheeler. Yeah.
All right, Tom Boger, follow him on Twitter. Tom Boger, go buy his shirts and his accessories at. No, I'm just kidding. Good to see you, Tom. Thanks for all the information, man. Keep grinding. We'll talk to you soon.
Cheers, fellas.
All right, big thanks to Tom for walking us through all that. It's a different era of MLS, Dave. I remember back in the day, we get one of these, couple of these a summer, and we were just overjoyed. Well, now it's an absolute flood of interest, of potential deals, and deals getting done for figures that we just haven't seen before. It's fun.
Yeah,
I'm extremely interested to see what the future of this league looks like and how all these players do once they do get overseas, if these deals do get done.
So like the Sam Vines one, it makes sense to me fully. But it's interesting that the Cole Bassett comp is not Brendan Aaronson and a Gio Reyna and a Weston McKennie. Like, why does it have to be the Rapids, right? He's had success in this league, similar to these other guys who have success in a similar position, in a similar style, and then have gone to Europe. And so that one surprised me a little bit because, for example, Tejan Buchanan, the Revs haven't sold anyone, right? Yeah. But yet there's still value there because he's playing well. He's playing with his national team, which is a little bit different, but not that much.
Reggie Cannon is a good comparison for Sam Vines, no?
Yeah, absolutely.
And like same sort of part of their career, had a ton of MLS experience at a young age, pushing into the national team. And yet Reggie Cannon's number was 3.5.
Yep.
But
Cole Bassett is an attack. A left back is different. A fullback is different than a 10 in a central midfield. Now, maybe people don't value Cole Bassett as a player individually, but it's odd that the comparison would be what would hold something back when look at what Tanner Tessman and Gianluca Busio are getting, and KC doesn't have a history of selling guys at a high level that have performed in Europe.
So I
think that's interesting, but I also think for Colorado, you do want to space it out to an extent, because unless you're going to spend heavily the money back into the team, you still want to have success with your MLS squad, and that also helps you bring the next generation through.
And they're having success right now. I do wonder, as Greg Berhalter said, if this critical mass will start to provide more data points and will start to change the market, especially as we see players go overseas and see what they do. All right, let's talk U.S. national team and Canadian national team. Gold Cup coming up this week, and the quarterfinals begin on Saturday. El Salvador Qatar might be the most interesting matchup of the entire quarterfinals, but U.S. and Canada are on Sunday. Canada comes first against Costa Rica, then the U.S. take on Jamaica. Let's start with the U.S. The news here recently was that basically CONCACAF is going to allow injury subs for players who can no longer continue. You have to go back to your provisional 60-man roster, but you can make some changes. Walker Zimmerman is clearly out. Henry Kessler is in camp right now. So is Cade Cowell. He's our 2222 player of the week presented by Body Armor because he has this opportunity. We don't know which of those two are going to make the replacement. Haven't seen any official word on Paul Areola. Maybe he is going to be available to go. I think they were saying in this last game that there was a chance he and Reggie were going to be good to go in that one. Who should be in for Greg Berhalter? And was Henry Kessler the right choice?
Yeah, so I think Justin Glad should be in. So clearly I'm in a spot that Greg Berhalter is not. I think he outplayed Kessler in Olympic qualifying on the same team. And I think he's outplayed him in MLS this year. John Bell's been really good for the Revs, and Kessler hasn't even gotten the full complement of games. It's just interesting. Is Donovan Pines ahead of these guys? If he is, then they're being brought in to be depth. And if it's a depth move, then maybe Cade Cowell does make sense because he actually changes the way you could play, right? Because you don't really have wing options. And when you look specifically at Jamaica, and maybe you're not going to start a Cade Cowell, their biggest weakness is at fullback. And so we don't have the pieces to really attack that weakness. Cade Cowell could bring you a little bit of that. And then Henry Kessler brings you depth unless you start him over Pines, which then why did you bring Pines on the roster instead of these guys? So a lot of it, I think, is a little murky and confusing. You go to that 60-man roster, Glad and Eric Palmer Brown are really the only other two center backs that would have had.
CCV maybe.
But I don't think he was on the provisional, was he?
I thought he was, but either way, he's not coming.
Yeah, none of them are clearly options. So this is where you're at. It makes sense to bring a center back if you need to for this team. I just haven't been impressed by Kessler at a national team level. I don't think he has the quickness, and I don't think he reads the game well enough yet to cover that.
Does this just depend on what Greg is thinking as far as like backline formation? I mean, essentially, is it, can James Sands just be that third center back? Do I need the depth if I have Pines perhaps coming off the bench? Like, how would you?
Well, if he's playing three in the back, Pines is a starter. Oh, so then he has no center back.
We had that many losses here.
Right. So then that's, I think either way, it's pretty high chance that it's Kessler, unless he thinks Sands can play in a back four as a center back. Because then you have Pines as an option off the bench if something happens. I'd be surprised if that's the way it goes. So if that's not the decision he makes, and we haven't really seen Sands in that space, then it's most likely going to be Kessler for that depth and for the run. Because you're hoping you get a win against Jamaica, which is completely not a guarantee. By the way, this is a really good Jamaica side. And when you look at the way Jamaica played in the group stage, even against Suriname, even against Guadeloupe, they didn't dominate possession. They're dangerous in transition, but they're lethal in transition. And I don't know that it matches up super well with what the U.S. has available to them. The U.S. has fullbacks who are probably better going forward than defending, and now a weakness in at center back, and not a pure defensive stopper at defensive midfield unless you play Sands there, who's kind of your only option. So I think this is a tough matchup for the U.S. Leon Bailey will play down that right side, so that's going to be Vines' job to deal with. And then I think the biggest weakness for Jamaica is whether it's Alvis Powell or O'Neill Fisher at right back. Leon Bailey is probably the best player on the field on Sunday, and either one of those who starts is probably the worst player on the field. And so the U.S. is going to have to find ways to neutralize Bailey and target that left back spot. And then the big other thing is Decadorva Reed tested positive for COVID, missed the last two games of the group stage. Seems like he's going to be unavailable again. So the U.S. should be able to control possession in midfield. They have not been dangerous when that's happened. They've been worse when that happens in creating chances. Can they shift that in this one? Does Williamson, Legette, Roldan, which of them gets the look in there to try and change that?
That could depend on if it's two strikers, no? What would you do? I'm sitting here thinking about Giassi or DK. You wouldn't put them together again.
Yeah.
I would want to have two guys underneath, and maybe that's Roldan and Legette. Maybe, I don't know what the mixture that you would want there is. I think I would go with Giassi.
As the starter by himself.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think that makes sense as well. I wouldn't go both of them. It just looked uncomfortable. It looked poor. I thought Hoppy looked okay underneath.
It could be,
DK
Hoppy
and Roldan
could be good. Yeah.
So I think there's a chance there if you want to have that option on the field, but someone who's more comfortable playing underneath. So I think that makes sense. For DK, the one thing that's interesting here is most of the backline for Jamaica plays in the championship. So he's actually played against a lot of these guys over the last 7-8 months and had success. Liam Moore is a monster in the back, but I think that's a natural battle for DK. So I think he would be more comfortable in this game, but it's a knockout game. It's a must-win game. I think you trust Zardes. And then
he's
for me,
just as valuable as a bench player, too. I mean, imagine him coming off in the 65th when you need a goal.
Right.
Yeah, that can change the game, and those are the sort of things they may have to do here in these knockout rounds.
I think Williamson has to get a start. I would be surprised if it's both Legette and Roldan. The only thing I could see is one of them plays out wide if it's a 4-3-3. Yep. And I think Legette could be comfortable there, and he could help you there. If you look at that first goal against Canada, even in playing the position he played, right, he was still able to help you create opportunities out wide.
All right, let's mourn a little bit for Canada. They got Costa Rica. It's a big game for them. All of this is basically practice for World Cup qualifying, which is what they've been building towards for a long time now. But Ayo and Kyle Larin both out. Ayo out for, it seems, the entirety of this season.
Yeah.
This is a new Canada. This is an ambitious Canada. It is still a Canada that's missing their biggest parts. Jonathan David here, not here, neither is Alphonso Davies. What do you want to see from them in this game against Costa Rica, apart from the obvious, which is an ability to get a result in a tough situation?
I think you look up top and you still have quality in Cavallini and someone who can do similar things to what you were getting from Ayo and Larin. And then you look at a Costa Rica team that they've stumbled over their own feet throughout this competition. They continue to play the same older faces who underperform but do just enough to get you through. And they seem scared to give the younger players opportunity. So I think this is a game that Canada should, one, both control midfield, and two, win. I think this is a better matchup than Jamaica would have been for this Canadian national team. And I think even without Laren and without Io, this is a good enough roster to get that done. I would like to see Junior Hollett get another opportunity as that second forward because of his, he's going to come off that front line and create chances, which Laren was doing, but Cavallini can't do in the same way. And then you know you're getting that threat from Tejan. Keisher Fuller has struggled in this tournament so far. I'm a fan of him, but he hasn't been good. So I think that's a place for Tejan to take advantage and create chances. And then you've got that midfield three back. And so Stakio can come back into the team. You can play K without worrying about anything, and Oso as well. I like this matchup for Canada. As long as you can track Joel Campbell in transition, which Canada did really well with our strikers, mainly Kamal Miller finding DK all over the place and making last-ditch tackles. As long as you can do that, this is a winnable game for Canada, and I think it's fair to have that expectation. Again, the sky isn't falling if they don't win, but this is an opportunity for them to push themselves into a semifinal.
All right, you got to practice winning, and now's a good time to do it. Both those games on Sunday, we'll be here, Extra Time Club and Country, driven by Continental Tire, after the final whistle of the U.S. game to break down both and to look ahead to the semifinals. So stay with us on that one. We'll have Twitter Spaces for the U.S. lineup as well. MLS Live on ESPN Plus this weekend, a ton of games. Go check those out. Let's end with the mailbag here and get out of here. Dave, what do we got?
My MLS Live game, by the way, since you asked, which you didn't, is Minnesota hosting Portland. You got to be on for that one. That one's Saturday, 8 p.m. Eastern time. For mailbag, we have fans who are mad because Charlie said that it's like the U.S. is given right to get to a quarterfinal and a semifinal in the Gold Cup. But Charlie's flight got canceled at 5 a.m. today, so I'm not going to jump up and down on him.
Yeah, there was like a please tell Charlie to stop spreading misinformation here. That's the way it started. Yeah. So, look, Charlie was wrong. We corrected him on the show. I've been at semifinals that the U.S. lost. I've been at third place games. It is not their God-given right to go to the final and win it. We've already talked about.
But historically, we make semifinals.
Yes, we make the semifinal. Yes.
We lost once in 2000. That kind of still leans into the historically we make semifinals. We got an email here from the home of the original KFC. Sitting here watching Cincinnati Atlanta game and seeing Acosta on the ground in pain so much has me worried. Now, you should worry less because it seems like he goes down when nothing happens. Yes. But Cincinnati does not have any player that could slot in and play as a true number 10 if he gets injured. Is there a young player somewhere in the league Cincinnati could sign as a backup 10 that could provide some valuable cover for minutes if Acosta gets injured again?
I would argue that that is a minimal need for FC Cincinnati. I think they have a lot of other needs that would trump that. And if Acosta does go down, then I think, as they are oftentimes now, most effective in transition, they would just need to turn to that. They would need to have two strikers, play with wingers, and just try to go direct. I mean, I think they have the personnel to play that way. Does Acosta make them better? Yes, because nobody on that roster can do the things he does with the ball. And we saw that in this game against Atlanta. But I don't think that their priority in a transfer window would be to go out and get a backup for him. You just change the way you play because nobody you get is going to be like Lucho Acosta.
Okay, but let me give you two names in MLS where they could fit in this spot. Fabian Herbers would be one. He still gets starts for Chicago, but can you in some way help them get relief to start to make some moves outside of MLS, probably defensively? And the other one would be Nicholas Mesquita, where Brian Galvan started to come on for Colorado. So you've got him as an option. Obviously, Nomley's injury makes it harder, but they still have Benize. All those pieces, can you give them something that interests them? And we're talking low level here, but we have seen that guys in this league, when the right fit is found, sometimes can overperform and be something that they weren't for their former team. So those are two that come to mind. But you're right, they'd probably just play a Tonga or Kubo and get after it in transition.
Yeah, I'm knocking on wood because we don't see Lucho injured. All right, have a good weekend, everybody. Let us know what you think of what goes down in MLS and in the Gold Cup. We'll be back on Sunday night for sure, and then Monday as well to wrap up everything in MLS with Doyle. So stay tuned, follow us at Extra Time, and subscribe and rate if you haven't already. Please do so. It helps us. All right, enjoy your weekend, everybody. We'll be right back.